in 1990.
Yes. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Alice, who has just returned. And special welcome. Today we have four special invited guests. Today is 23rd of November. On 24th November 1994, 20 years ago, Mr. Suresh Day, who was then secretary of the Auroville Foundation, invited a whole group of Aurovillians, maybe about 30, 35 people, and proposed to us that we should start a Savitri study circle in Auroville. So that was taken up by some of us. And out of that Savitri study circle, which started 20 years ago tomorrow, all this, all of Savitri Bhavan, all its activities, everything has grown. So all of us, whether you know him or not, you all owe a great debt of gratitude to Suresh Dah. And I specially invited him and his family to be with us on this 20th anniversary session. And I just received the very good news that his two daughters, Lena and Shiva, are newcomers and they are joining Auroville. So we welcome them too. And both Mr. and Mrs. Day are musicians, beautiful singers. They have given performances here and shared their wonderful skills with us. I don't know whether the daughters have followed in the same footsteps and whether we can expect beautiful music from them, but we hope to see you many more times in Auroville. So I just want to make a small presentation. These are two products of Savitri Bhavan. So in a way, you are their father or godfather. Don't get Thank you. Give these to the girls to look after. Yes. Bag which you can give them. So we don't know how many times we have read Savitri since that day. We lost count. But now we are approaching again the end of book three. We are on page 344 in canto 4, The Vision and the Boon. We stopped at line 389. So we're going to start on the last line of page 344. We're following the same pattern that we did from the beginning, that we read a whole canto first and then we go back and look at it in more detail. So now we're doing the detailed reading. And would you like to read first, please, from the bottom of page 344, last line?
390.
Yes.
Heavy, unchanged ways, still the imperfect world. The splendid youth of time has passed and failed. Heavy and long are the years, our labor counts, and still the seals are firm upon man's soul, and weary is the ancient mother's heart. O truth, defended in thy secret son, voice of her mighty musings in shut heavens, on things withdrawn within her luminous depths. O wisdom splendor, mother of the universe, creatrix, the eternal's artist bride, linger not long with thy transmuting hand, pressed vainly on one golden bar of time, as if time dare not open its heart to God.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll pause there. These are as we still have room. We just read the first passage, starting at the bottom of page 344, line 390, and we read two sentences to line 402. We are coming to the end of this speech of Asvapati in response to the mother. She has asked him to return to earth and continue doing her work there. She knows very well that what he wants is a full descent of her love and light and power to the earth, for earth and men. But she told him, don't ask for that. Whatever you have won, whatever great spiritual achievements you have, these are yours. Nobody can take them away from you. But don't ask, you can't ask on behalf of all this blind humanity that doesn't know, that doesn't aspire, that isn't ready. And she gave him a long explanation, but she, at the same time, she promised him that when the time comes, God's transfiguring hour, then everything will change. But for now, she says, be patient. But there's something in Asvapati which can't accept that. His heart replies to her. And it complains a bit. He said, it's all taking too long, and it's so difficult. And we don't get any hint of your coming. There's no gleam of light or anything. But then he says, I know that your creation can't fail. I've had a wonderful vision, and he shares with us his vision, that at a time when the world seems to be in a state of complete dissolution and destruction, and there's a giant dance of Shiva tearing the past, in that moment he sees the flaming pioneers coming into the human world. Wonderful beings whose tread is going to justify the light on nature's face. So he says, I know that is going to come, but meanwhile, it's all taking so long, no? And the world seems to be unchanged. Time, the splendid youth of time, has passed. We're counting these heavy, long years of labor, and still the seals seem to be firmly fixed on the soul of humanity. It's not opening. And weary is the ancient mother's heart. I think this is Mother Earth. She has toiled all through these eons, and some things have been evolved. But now she's weary and suffering. We can see her suffering. So then again he prays to the mother as truth. He says, O truth, defended in thy secret son. You are there, protected. We can't reach you. But you are the voice of the ancient mother. You are the voice of her mighty musings in shut heavens, on things withdrawn within her luminous depths. Deep within the earth mother is the supreme mother. You, wisdom splendor, you who are mother of the universe, you have created all this. You're the creatrix. You're the bride of the eternal artist. Please don't stay too long. Linger not long with thy transmuting hand, your hand that can change things, can transform things. It seems to be pressed on one golden bar of time, as if time dare not open its heart to God. As long as you keep your hand pressed on that one golden bar, then things can't change. So let us see what he says to her next. Mrs. Day, would you read?
Radiant fountain of the world's delight, world free and unattainable above. O bliss, whoever dwells deep within, while men seek thee outside and never find, mystery and muse with
hieratic
tongue, incarnate the white passion of thy force, mission to earth some living form of thee. One moment filled with thy eternity, let thy infinity in one body. All knowledge left on mind in series of life, all love thought sing in one human heart.
Thank you. Thank you. Such a wonderful prayer, no? He addresses her as the bliss, the source of the world's delight. And he asks her to send to earth, mission to earth, some living form of thee. Incarnate yourself. Fill one moment with thy eternity. Let all your infinity live in one body. All your knowledge wrap one mind in seas of light. All love throb single in one human heart. This is his prayer. It's completely different from Aswapati's prayer in the legend of Savitri. His prayer then, of course, probably it is a symbolic prayer. What he wanted was 100 sons. He wanted there to be many people with his own realization. But Savitri, the Supreme Mother, told him that the Lord is giving you one daughter. And don't be sad, because that daughter will be worth 100 sons to you. So, but here, Aswapati is conscious of what he's asking for. What he's asking for is an incarnation of the Supreme Divine Mother on earth. Anybody has any questions about these lines?
Mystery and news with hieratic
So he referred to her as truth and bliss. Another way of thinking of the Supreme Mother is that she's a great mystery, an unknowable mystery. And she's also the source of all inspiration. A muse is a divine goddess who sends inspiration, inspires musicians or poets or artists. A muse who sends inspiration. So you are that mystery and muse, he says, with a hieratic tongue. You speak in a language that not everybody can understand. Hieratic, it has to do with a priest who is an intermediary between ordinary human beings and the divine. So she's, elsewhere she's referred to as the mediatrix, the one who links us to the Supreme. You speak to us, give us messages with your hieratic tongue. Lina, would you read to the end of the section?
Immortal, treading the earth with mortal feet, all heaven's beauty crowd in earthly limbs. Omnipotence, girdle with the power of God. Movements and moments of a mortal will, pack with the eternal might of one human hour, and with one gesture change all future time. Let a great word be spoken from the heights, and one great act unlock the doors of fate.
Thank you. Anything to ask or share? Yes, Tom.
Seems you go back to the various religions there, there seems to be that one act which changes man's fate. It's in the Ten Commandments, perhaps, in Judaism there, the Buddha's enlightenment.
Yeah, and of course there's a series of such great acts, but Asvapati is asking for that great act which will unlock all the resistances that are there and all the predeterminations that are operating in the material universe, that all that this one, you yourself in a mortal form, please come and do this great act that will change the future, change all the future time.
So what gives him the idea? I mean, if he turns to the world of solitude?
Yes.
What changed his mind?
To ask for this.
Instead of humble sons.
No, she told him, look, it's not time now. So he's saying, well, then please come or send an emanation of yourself that will prepare, who will be able to make things ready so that it can happen. So it's a powerful prayer, but it's followed by a silence. Seems as if it's impossible what he's asking. You read?
His prayer sank down in the resisting night, oppressed by the thousand forces that deny, as if too weak to climb to the Supreme. But there arose a wide, consenting voice. The spirit of beauty was revealed in sound. Light floated round the marvelous vision's brow, and on her lips the immortal's joy took shape. O strong forerunner, I have heard thy cry. One shall descend and break the iron law, change nature's doom by the lone spirit's power. A limitless mind that can contain the world, a sweet and violent heart of ardent calms, moved by the passions of the gods, shall come.
Thank you. So, a wide, consenting voice. She's saying yes. I've heard thy cry. Someone will come. And then she's describing this one who will come. It's also a beautiful picture of Savitri. Morrigan, you would read?
O strong foreigner, I have heard thy cry. One shall defend and break the iron law, change nature's doom by the lone spirit's power, a limitless mind that can contain the world, a sweet and violent heart of ardent calm, moved by the patience of the gods shall come, all mighties and greatnesses shall join in earth, beauty shall walk celestial on the earth, delight shall sleep in the cloudness of her hair, and in her body a song is foaming free. Immortal love shall be his glorious wing. The music of breathless things shall view her charm. The harps of the perfect shall attune her voice. The streams of heaven shall murmur in her love. Her lips shall be the honeycomb of God. Her limbs, his golden jaws of ecstasy, her bridge of the rapture flowers of paradise. She shall bear wisdom in her voiceless bosom. Strength shall be with her like a conqueror's sword, and from her eyes the eternal bliss shall gaze. A seed shall be sown in death's tremendous hour, a branch of heaven transplant to human soil. Nature shall overleap a mortal step. Fate shall be changed by an unchanging will.
Thank you. First, there's the promise, no? One shall descend and break the iron law, change nature's doom by the lone spirit's power. And then there's the description, the limitless mind, the sweet and violent heart, this passionate heart of Savitri, moved by the passions of the gods. All kinds of powers, mights, and all kinds of greatness, they will all come together in this one, in her. Divine beauty will walk on the earth. Celestial beauty. Delight shall sleep in the cloud net of her hair. Beautiful poetry, love poetry, and in her body, as on his homing tree, immortal love shall beat his glorious wings, like a great god with wings, or like a great bird. He has his own tree, Savitri, at the very beginning of the poem, Sri Aurobindo told us all the qualities which make her the perfect shrine for love, which is the burning test of Godhead in our parts. When love comes to us, it is testing us to see how far we've developed and how far we are able to express that divine power of love. Savitri is able to house spiritual love, which can make all things divine. And the thing about her is that she will represent freedom from grief. A music of griefless things will weave her charm. That's what's so characteristic of her, is this happiness, this inviolable happiness, which spreads happiness around it. And she'll have a beautiful voice. The harps of the perfect shall attune her voice. They'll be tuned. And her laughter be like the streams of heaven. Her lips containing the honey of God. And all her body will be like jars, beautiful golden jars containing divine ecstasy. Her breasts, the rapture flowers of paradise. This is all the aspects of her beauty. But she shall also bear wisdom in her voiceless bosom. This is this quality of silence that is there in Savitri. And strength. Sri Aurobindo's written a letter about it, and he says that these are the two outstanding qualities of Savitri, which he refers to again and again. Silence and strength. She'll have strength like the sword of a conqueror. And from her eyes, the Eternal's bliss shall gaze. And then again comes the promise that a seed shall be sown in death's tremendous hour. Yes.
You know where Shobindo wrote letter when you said
this letter about strength and silence?
Yes.
Well, there's a collection of his letters on this poem. And it's one of those there.
Thank you.
This reference to death's tremendous hour, of course, is a kind of prophecy. We can think that when Aspapati hears this, he doesn't know what that hour of death will be. But death is one of the things that needs to be conquered in the material world in order for there to be a divine life here in a human body, in a material body. A branch of heaven transplant to human soil. And we have a very good variety of mango. We will cut a branch and transplant it to a good strong stock, you know, of another mango, and then it can be planted somewhere else. It's the way of propagating mangoes or roses or so from heaven, from the divine being, there will be a transplant made into human soil, and this will allow earthly nature to overleap, to take a big leap forward beyond her present mortal step of humanity, which is subject to death and ignorance. She promises that fate shall be changed by an unchanging will. So we are on page 346 now, and all the rest of the poem tells us about the fulfillment of this promise. Fulfillment of this promise. It's as if this is where part one of the poem is coming to an end, and the part two and three will be Savitri's story. So far we've been following Aspapati's story. And Sri Aurobindo, in the last section now, he has to wrap up Aspapati's part of the story. And in the next book, we'll see the birth of Savitri, the birth and childhood of the flame. Would you like to read, Anshuman?
As a flame disappears in endless light, immortally extinguished in its source, vanished the splendor and was still the world, an echo of delight that once was closed. The harmony journeyed towards some distant hush, the music filling in the ear of trance, the cadence called by distant cadences, a voice that trembled into strains withdrawn. Her form retreated from the long hour, forsaking nearness to the abundant sense, ascending to her unattainable home. Lone, brilliant, vacant lay the inner fields. All was unfilled, inordinate space.
A mother withdraws. Wonderful description of that disappearance. There has been the vision, and it's as if absorbed into endless light. A retreat. And it leaves a sense of emptiness, the inner fields of Asvapati's consciousness are lying vacant, unfilled, inordinate spirit space. It's so vast, it seems too vast because it's empty.
Noticing the way the poet has bracketed this vision, and I'd love to hear your comment. At the beginning of this section on 345 at the bottom,
yeah,
his prayers sank down in the resisting night, so it's in a space of some kind, hanging there, sinking. And then she is leaving, and then there is this space.
Empty space, yeah. Of course, it's all inner space. This is all happening in Asvapati's consciousness. She has entered him, enveloped him. All this is going on inside his vast consciousness. But when he finished speaking, there's this sense of everything that resists. But then she consents. There's this wide consenting voice and this wonderful promise. But then she herself withdraws. She's made her promise. Now things will unroll. But for him, there's this sense of emptiness.
But peaceful emptiness, desert of peace.
Yeah. It's a desert. It doesn't sound entirely positive, no? It's vacant, it's empty.
Well, she's gone.
Yeah, but there's peace. But now something different is going to come. Norman, will you read?
Unlocked.
No.
Oh, sorry.
Then a line moved.
Sorry? Here.
Then a line moved.
Then a line moved on the far edge of calm, the warm lipped sentient, soft terrestrial wave. A quick and many murmured moan and laugh came gliding in upon white feet of sun. Unlocked was the deep glory of silence half. The absolute unmoving stillness surrendered to the breath of mortal air, dissolving boundlessly the heaven of trance, collapsed to waking mind. Eternity cast down in incommunicable days over its solitudes remote from ken upon the voiceless mystery of sleep. The grandiose respite failed. The wide release.
Thank you. So the life of earth comes flowing back like a wave. It starts like a line on the far edge of that silence. Warm-lipped, sentient, it's living. Soft, terrestrial wave. It's moving with many feet, you know, like a wave comes in, many foaming feet, and these feet make a sound. And it's not purely a material sound, a physical sound. It's a living sound. He says it's quick. Quick means it's alive. And there are many voices there in creating this moan and this laugh. So this is the rumor of the speed of life flowing back in. And so state of trance that he's been in, these just these heavens, they just dissolve, collapse, and he's back in his waking mind, his earthly consciousness. And it's as if eternity is closing its eyes. So all those wonderful states that he's been experiencing in these solitudes, which are so remote from our human awareness, they are hidden behind this voiceless mystery of sleep. Now he's awake. He's back in the world, aware of the world around him. So that wonderful respite, that pause, that wide release from all the limitations of earth, that's over now. But he still seems to be on quite a high level. Now he has to come down. Don, would you read it?
Across the night, the fast receding planes that fled from him as from a falling star, compelled to fill its human house in time. His soul drew back into the speed and noise of the vast business of created things. A chariot of the marvels of the heavens, broad-based to bear the gods on fiery wheels, flaming he swept through the spiritual gates. The mortal stir received him in its mist. Once more he moved amid material scenes, lifted by the intimations from the heights, and in the pauses of the building brain, touched by the thoughts that skim the fathomless surge of nature and wean back to hidden shores. The eternal seeker in the aeonic field, besieged by the intolerant press of hours, again was strong for great swift.
Let's stop there. Pocket. Remember that? One-pointed. He goes up like a rocket. Now it's the opposite thing. Now he's gone through this whole enormous inner venture on higher planes, and now his soul has to come back. And Sri Aurobindo describes it like a falling star. And he's passing through all the planes of manifestation. He's been beyond the manifestation the last couple of cantos. He has to come back, so it's as if he's zooming down and those planes are receding, fast receding. His soul is again compelled, it has to come back to fill its human house in time, its individual body and formation. So here he is, back into the speed and noise of the vast business of created things. And then there's this wonderful image of his being as a chariot. This is a Vedic image that the great heroes, the kings, those old kings who had the higher wisdom, they were considered to be, their beings were considered to be chariots for the gods. They would be carrying the gods with them. And particularly I remember the story of King Pururavas, Pururavas, who is a legendary king who fell in love with a apsara from the court of Indra, the god of mind. And Indra met Urvasi because Indra called him to fight with him against the dark forces, the adverse forces. So the two of them, Pururavas as the chariot and Indra as the mind of light, they'd been fighting against the gods, the dark gods. So he comes back like that in his chariot. So Asvapati is sweeping through the spiritual gates and back into the mortal stir, the life of earth. So once more he's moving here as we do amid these material scenes. But his consciousness is lifted up sometimes by intimations, by hints, by inspirations, messages coming from the higher planes. And when the building brain, the active surface brain, pauses, he gets touched by thoughts from higher levels that come down like birds. You know, we see swallows particularly, they come down and they just take a sip of water, or they just catch an insect and whoops, off they again. So it's like that. These thoughts come down and they skim this fathomless surge, the ocean of nature, and then they wing back to hidden shores.
It's a bluebird.
Bluebirds do it, but
the fish coming in the water.
Yeah.
Kingfishers.
Kingfishers do that and catch fish. Yes. But there are insect catchers. You know, the insects are on the surface of the water. They go. That's skimming. They just touch for a moment. So these high thoughts come, they just touch for a moment, and then they are gone again. Asvapati is the eternal seeker in the aeonic field. That's what he's been representing, the divine in the form of a seeker in this field of time, the aeonic field. Now he's back, besieged by human time, the intolerant press of hours. And again, here on earth, in his body, he's strong for great, swift-footed deeds. He's a king. He has a lot to do here on earth. Amitoj, you would read?
Awake beneath the ignorant vault of night, he saw the unnumbered people of stars and heard the questioning of the unsatisfied flood, and toiled with the form maker measuring mind, a wanderer from the occult invisible sun, accomplishing the fate of transient things, a god in the figure of the arisen beast. He raised his brow of conquest to the heavens, establishing the empire of the soul on matter and its bounded universe, as on a solid rock in infinite sea. The law of life presumes its mighty wrong in the stand scene of the animal spirit.
Why does he call unnumbered people the stars?
Can we count the stars?
Just to relate the...
Yeah. But of course all these lines are symbolic. No? Here he is, he's awake beneath this ignorant vault, the night sky. Mm. It's the darkness that we haven't yet penetrated, but it's lit up by all these unnumbered stars, and each of them is a sun of truth, actually. We see them as tiny little dots of light, but they are the infinite truths. This unsatisfied flood, I think this is the ocean of life. And it's questioning why, where, how. And he has to work with mind. And that's hard work. At the very beginning we were told he's a thinker and a toiler in the ideal Zaya. So again, he has to toil with this mind which creates forms. He's come as a wanderer from those hidden, invisible suns. He came as a colonist, actually, originally. That's what it tells us at the beginning of Canto 3. And here he's accomplishing, he's going through and fulfilling the fate of transient things here in our world that's subject to death. In his consciousness, he's a god. He's a very, very highly realized being. But he's wearing this figure, this form of the arisen beast, the human form. Still an animal form, but it is one that has stood erect. So he, as a great king, he raises his brow of conquest to the heavens, he looks up, and here on earth he's establishing the empire, the rule of the soul on matter and on this bounded universe of matter. He's establishing the rule of the soul here as on a solid rock that's surrounded by infinite seas. And Sri Aurobindo calls him the Lord of Life, which refers to his name, Aswapati, which means Lord of the Horse. And the horses are the life energies, or the universal energies. So now he's resuming, he's got hold of his horses again, and he's resuming his mighty rounds, whatever work he has to do here on our earth, on the scant field, this very limited little field of the ambiguous earth where everything's doubtful and we don't understand much.
That's the globe is ambiguous in that those who reside in the globe don't know, don't understand the globe.
Yes, and because at the moment the significance of this globe, this earth, is not clear.
Yeah.
It's, yeah.
When you tell establishing the empire of the soul, maybe it's also some aspect of the empire of the soul. when coming through. Nava is a vision.
Yes, it's a vision. That's what we feel that Sri Aurobindo and Mother have done, no?
Yeah.
They've established the empire of the soul here. They've brought the supramental, and we will see what that rule will bring. But we are also supposed to collaborate with it.
Yeah.
We have something to do.
May I say, there is an interesting anecdote.
Yes.
That many of you might be knowing, the sun god, who is the father of
Savitri,
is also called Saptashwabahana, seven horses in the chariot.
Yes.
Saptashwabahana is the vehicle.
Yes.
So Lord Sun God is also mentioned as Saptashwabahana.
Yes. So that's him here, no? Flaming this chariot.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. Yes, there are so many levels of suggestion in this wonderful language of Sri Aurobindo's, and I'm sure we can always go on finding new wonderful things. Thank you for sharing that particular insight.
But also your question, Shalavan, when Sri Aurobindo said, as on the solid rock, in infinite sea.
Hmm.
What is a solid rock?
The solid rock is matter, he says it. All the infinite planes of existence.
Of existence.
Yes. So it's a little early. I don't know if anybody has anything they would like to ask, or we can close early today. Yes, Margaret.
By looking and editing the talks from Sri Kiritjoshina, it's very interesting to read also the seven rivers of Sri Aurobindo, the smoke of the Veda, or the Agni and Jews. It gives so much light on this understanding of the God's relation to the mortal, and the relation and how these energies are flowing, and this ways of consciousness has to be built up. No?
These seven rivers, they represent different divine energies. So in the same way, the seven horses.
Yes.
Mm. And the sun god has them all.
But solid rock also is the foundation, no?
Sorry?
It is some foundation. But before, he said on the matter,
yes,
of its bound universe, as on the solid rock.
So matter is like a solid rock on which the soul is going to, has established its empire, its rule. Aswapati has started that process.
Okay.
Now Savitri will be born, and the process will go further. He's done the preparatory work.
No,
she's going to do. Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Maybe one more point. As the flame disappears in endless light, born by endless Agni and the truth, and it's what I understood more and more, this aspiration and Agni, the inner flame on all levels of existence. That is the carrier, the things are higher and higher. And here's the Divine Mother described, and she is it there also, her love and life.
Yes.
The flame disappears in light.
In endless light, immortally extinguished in its source.
Yeah.
Immortally extinguished, it sounds paradoxical, no? Mm-hmm. Extinguished means that something is finished, but it's being extinguished in its source, so it's going to go on forever and ever. So this is, she has projected herself as a vision in order for Aswapati to be able to communicate with her in this very intimate way.
Mm-hmm.
Now she's drawing back into this infinite light.
Yeah, this two poles is also very much described in this Agni and Truth. that he is a worker on the earth in Meta, but his real home is the infinite, the eternal manner. So this.
So we've completed one part of the great adventure, and next week we'll start on part two. Today let's hear all the passages for this canto, passages read by the mother.
An influence had approached the mortal age. A boundless heart was near his longing heart. A mystic form enveloped his earthly shape. Mighty face appeared and lips moved by immortal words. Giant dance of Shiva tore the past. I saw the omnipotent flaming pioneer over the heavenly world which turns towards light. Come crowding down the amber stairs of birth, forerunners of a divine multitude, out of the paths of the morning star they came into the little home of mortal light. Descend and break the iron law change nature's doom by the lone spirit's power. His soul drew back into the speed of noise of the vast business of creation.